let's get going. Oh, there's Thea. Oh, we have one more cookie hunter. It's okay. Welcome, everybody. If anybody has challenges with their projects, please let me know. I'm here to help. I can't read minds. If I could, then I wouldn't have to ask this question. But if you have any problems at all, let me know. I'm available all day tomorrow for meetings with teams and other people. So if you want to meet with me, just write a note or send me an email. Don't tell me because I tend to forget things. So let me know. I'll be around all tomorrow. I want to thank you for participating in that small evaluation groups on Tuesday. It worked out really well. I talked to Robin on yesterday, and I want to thank you for all the good words you had to say about the class. Great. And I want to also thank you for continuing to fill out these forms. They give me a lot of input on how the class is going and your thoughts. I'm always interested in what you're thinking about the class. I'm always open for suggestions and comments. I really want to hear what you have to say. So keep those cards and letters coming in. I want to talk a little bit about team projects. This is a refresher for everybody. This is what I expect you to have gone through by next week. This is all in your assignment one tasks. It would be great in your presentation if you got down to your top three design choices and have an idea of which one you want to pursue. So that's what I'm looking for next week are the team project presentations. And I'll be sending out an email tomorrow with more information regarding that. So watch your email tomorrow. Among the other things that I can do is help you with an outline of your presentation or slides. I'll be happy to listen to a practice presentation that you have and offer suggestions and at no cost to you. This is free. Okay. And as I mentioned, I'll be around tomorrow to meet with you. And what I like to do for the presentations is have everybody send me their slides. And it'd be good if you all worked in PowerPoint, and then I can install them on the laptop, and we wouldn't have to go through the changes that you need going from one laptop to another. And if I can get everybody's slides, it'll work really smoothly. So if you can send it to me by the end of the day on Wednesday, that would be perfect. Any videos you can send me as well. I can load them on my laptop as well, and it'll work better that way. Or you can upload them to YouTube and have links on your slides to them. That's another thing that works. If you have any questions, let me know. This is actually a very important issue about deadlines and objectives. You as a student in this class, you have certain deadlines as far as presentations about your project. But the people that you're talking to, whether they've been have suggested the project or are an ultimate user, they have they're on a different agenda, okay? In their deadline and their objectives, they may want to see something that is like ready to be commercialized, that works perfectly, and is available right now. But in reality, to get something to that point may take, months and years, and you don't have that in this class. So what they're thinking about and what you have to do for the class are two separate things. So you have to get that square in your mind that you're not going to be able, might not be able to produce something that's ready for the market. I don't expect that. You should have something that is a prototype, that is testing a concept, and is to the point where it's functional enough to try out and test with these people, but it's going to be by no means an end product, okay? So just beware of that. Okay, so a few things before we get started with the presentations. So the word of the day is sarcopenia. I went to a talk about this last week. It's the degenerate loss of muscle mass and strength associated but not caused by aging. So as people get older, typically they lose strength and muscle mass, which affects their balance and their mobility. In looking at this from the perspective of the instructor for this class, there's a lot of potential student projects that we can look at next year. I mean, you're not going to be here, but you know, we can look into walking and exercise motivation, ways of measuring muscle mass and strength that are really simple, and maybe there are some apps that might work out. So, sarcopenia. How many people have actually heard that term before? Okay, great, great. So for others, it's new, so you learned something today. That's good. This is a really important issue that came up last month. The Department of Education issued a guidance letter to public schools stating that sports and recreation activities are a right, and schools must therefore provide equal access to extracurricular sport activities to students with disabilities. So this is a huge change, and there's going to be, again, wide open for projects that would help meet the needs of students who want to participate in sports. So this is something that every school is going to have to deal with. So that's sort of interesting. So one thing I want to do is have you decide what I talk about in these little discussion sessions that are prior to lectures. So here are some of the choices. Maybe it's a little bit too late to introduce the teams and team members because we're doing presentations next Thursday. But I already have done a little discussion on old assistive technology. I can certainly report on new products and research that I see every day. I have a whole list of videos that I can show and we can discuss. I have ideas for looking at things that may not be politically correct, and we can discuss that. If a project team has a problem and they like to present the problem to the class for their input, that's another possibility. I have a talk in mind about how we view people with disabilities. Fun with ethics, or you can come up with another idea. If you have a topic that you want me to talk about, that'll be great. So does anybody have a preference for one of these things? If not, I was going to go with the old assistive technology for next time. Okay, we're going to do old assistive technology. Is that okay with everyone? If it's not okay, raise your hand. Okay, great. So I'm going to show one video today, and this is a chance for you to really focus on the video. And this is something that was in the news about a month or two ago. I want you to look at it, see about the device that's being shown, who it might benefit, you think the device is really going to be useful, if it's going to make it on the market, the key features, some unknown questions that you might have, and is it cool? So here's the article. This is actually about some Stanford grads working on a six-dot brailler. We have a short video. Is everybody ready? I should have brought popcorn. Yeah, takes a while to do this proxy setting stuff. Damn, sorry.
Okay, here we go.
Now, for somebody who's blind, the printed labels on everything from cereal boxes to medication bottles, they might as well be blank. But a group of recent Stanford graduates is changing that now. As ABC 7 News reporter Jonathan Globe explains, a business breakthrough is helping to change the lives of blind people.
This is a barometer.
Bill Gary has been blind his whole life, but it didn't stop him from becoming an engineer.
A micrometer that I copied and improved, I must say.
And designing tools made especially for blind people.
It has a whistle that changes pitch.
From a carpenter's level to a soldering iron, Gary has adapted almost every common tool except one.
Blind people don't have a pencil, or didn't, until the six-dot machine. This is the six-dot labeler, and it spits out a label like this.
Designed by a group of recent Stanford graduates at Stanford's StartX Business Accelerator, the six-dot labeler prints out sticky labels in Braille. The system of raised dots that used to require a huge typewriter-like device or strenuous manual writing like this.
It takes 4 pounds to make each dot.
Gary said it took more than 3 months to label all of the little drawers in his workshop. With the six-dot labeler, he said it would take about 3 days. An advancement so big that now the inventors of this device have hit the jackpot.
We've been sort of starving ourselves, living sort of in the red every month.
But not anymore. Robert Liebert and the other Stanford grads just announced a company is buying their startup and bringing them on as senior staff members. The newly formed Logan Technology also makes ProxTalker, a device for autistic kids, and plans to start mass-producing six-dot labelers in the next few months.
It's really a good fit for both parties.
In part, the interest came because six-dot isn't just for blind people. Anyone can make labels in Braille just by plugging in a keyboard.
Even if you don't know Braille, if you've never heard of Braille, really, if you know a blind person or you work with a blind person, you can print their labels for them.
As for Bill Gary, he's already labeled everything right down to his microwave oven.
There are things like pop for popcorn.
And he's not stopping anytime soon.
I'd like you to label that camera before you get out of here.
In San Francisco, Jonathan Bloom, ABC 7 News.
That's amazing, man.
Of course, if you were in this class 2 years ago, we had Bill Gary be a guest speaker, and he brought all that stuff with him. It was really interesting. So what do you think of the video? Anybody have any comments? Will?
I actually knew one of the people, or I saw one of the people.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah.
Back then, I think it's a pretty incredible improvement over what was existing. I don't know about usability, but... Really
yeah, so they spent about 5 years developing it, I think they sold they have an initial run which they sold. So I've seen it progress over the years. Anybody else have any comments on this? Andrew, you have any thoughts? What did you think of this device? You like it? You want one? No. What are some of the features that for blind people and also people who aren't blind? Yeah, go ahead.
I guess I'm curious as to like this configuration.
Oh, okay. Right. So there's 6 keys on it, and each key represents a dot. And so you press them... press one or more of them to create a Braille letter. So for each letter of the alphabet, there's a Braille configuration of 6 dots that represents that letter. And people, by feeling, understand, you know, the Braille as they scan it. And there's some people that actually can read Braille quite well. But not every blind person knows Braille. Anybody have any other comments on it? Yeah, Fred.
Rita Pickard, who was not shown in that video, was the driving force behind that.
Yes.
She's a master's in engineering here, formerly from MIT.
Right.
And they went over to the AOL building for StartX to take this thing, and they produced 100 machines, they sold those machines, and then they hit a wall. Fortunately, this other company came along and
What was the nature of the wall that they hit?
They ran out of money.
Oh, they ran out of money. Okay, a money wall, a lack of money. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. They did actually produce 100 machines.
Right. So one of the things you might not have noticed at the end, they added on the ability for to hook it up to a keyboard so that an able-bodied person could make labels for people who are blind. And that was a real good addition because, you know, not every person who is blind may want to use that. I mean, you can use it to help other folks. So that was something they added later. I should mention that there are a lot of Braille printers, and a lot of them are high speed, you know, for making Braille books. But they're very, very expensive because only a few of them are made. So do you think this device, what do you think the market is for this in the U.S.? You know, maybe there's a million blind people in the U.S. Do you think every blind person is going to need one or would want one? No. Tal says no. No. So it may have a limited market, and so who might be some of the people that might buy it besides blind people? I was thinking maybe schools, other places like that. Maybe they'd want to have one here. Any place where they have clients who are blind, this might be useful for them. I'm not sure what the price is on this, but it's probably...
It was about $300.
$300? Well, that's pretty reasonable. Okay. Okay. So, on Tuesday, we're going to have a talk on Alzheimer's from Philip and Rita, and this ought to be pretty interesting because we met this afternoon and we discussed what they're going to say, so it'll be fun. I should mention that the sixth dot will be at the Assistive Technology Fair in a couple weeks. 2 weeks from today will be the Assistive Technology Fair, so you'll have a chance to use it up close in person. Today we're going to have a talk on prosthetics and by Satki and Gary. And so what we'll do now is take a little break and reconfigure our setup. It's a chance for you to come down and sign in, get a cookie. I have more cookies, pick up an evaluation form, and generally cool out for a moment. Thank you. Chill out.
Chill out.
Chill out.
There you go.
I got it.
Stand on this side. Yeah, that's right. behind something. Yeah. Wonder if this is switched on.
As an orthopedic and hand surgeon, and has been involved here at Stanford teaching in anatomy and basic surgery for many years. He's also taught the medical device design class at 8294 for the last few years. He's taught medical students, paramedical students, residents, undergraduates, and engineering students in the School of Anatomy here. He's also been involved in teaching activities in the Division of Hand Surgery at Stanford. And Gary Burke is an adjunct clinical instructor and director of prosthetics in Stanford's Department of Orthopedic Surgery. And he's owner of his own clinical practice in prosthetics. He has lectured and worked nationally and internationally on prosthetic care and has multiple publications. He has a keen interest in investigating cost-effective technologies for enhancing the life of those who require these prosthetics while reducing the cost of these devices. So let's have a warm Stanford welcome for us.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. Good afternoon, everyone. After that introduction, I think you know a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. It's good to see some familiar faces and some new faces. What Gary and I are going to talk about today is the topic of prosthetics. And I'm going to stand sort of in the corner here so I can get to my laptop a little bit, but I'm going to try and come out as frequently as I can. Prosthetics really is a field of medicine or surgery that deals with the replacement of missing body parts. So the production and application of artificial body parts. And those artificial body parts are called prosthesis, and there are many types of prosthesis. This is a artificial heart valve. This is also a prosthesis, which comes under the classification. This one you will recognize as an artificial eye. This is an artificial tooth, very common. And this is an artificial hip that is used as part of hip replacement surgery. This is a sometimes called as an endoprosthesis because it goes inside the body and gets implanted. We're not going to talk about any of these. What we're going to talk about today are prostheses such as this one, which is for the missing leg, or this one, which is for the missing hand or arm. And this is a special category of prosthesis that is needed for people who've undergone amputations, amputations of one of the limbs, upper or lower limb, or more than one limb. And if we try to look at amputations and prostheses, people talk about prostheses in different ways, and people who need prostheses have different expectations from these. We talk about beauty as part of being the way people look at themselves and hope they will get from prostheses. We talk about confidence, and this is a large population of folks who need prostheses. We also talk about mobility, or in the upper limb, function. And prosthesis, it has been an attempt of prosthesis designers and folks who are working with amputees to try and provide as much of this as possible. We've succeeded in part, but not entirely. And it'll probably be helpful to know the users that we're dealing with. The patient profile, the patient population that we're dealing with that make up this group of individuals with amputations. So if we look at people who've undergone amputations, we can look at them in three different ways. One is based on the cause that has led to amputation. One is the demographics. And the third is by the level of amputation. So these are really the four big causes of amputations for the upper and lower limb. And the first two, disease and trauma, really add perhaps 90% of the causes of amputations. And if we look at the upper and lower limb, it is a little different. The lower limb, the great majority of the amputations is because of peripheral vascular disease. Maybe because of diabetes, or may not be because of diabetes, but there is some disease which is underlying cause, and then it has further, at the end result is an amputation. That's the primary cause in lower limb in the U.S. population. About one-fourth is caused by trauma, and then the other two, tumor and congenital differences, forms really a very small part. In the upper limb, the large majority of patients, the cause is trauma, three-fourths. And the other causes are much less. And it's also important to note that really lower limb to upper limb, the ratio is about 5:1 globally. If you look at worldwide population, it's about 5:1. That's why I made the lower limb chart much larger, just so that you get that impression and carry away that idea in your mind. If you look in the U.S., the population is skewed even more so towards the lower limb population, perhaps 8:1 or even 9:1. And if you look at the lower limb as well as the upper limb, there is a distribution based on age, and the demographics is a little different. So in the U.S., we have a total population of about 1.7, perhaps 1.8 million patients with amputations of one type or the other, which comes to about 1 in every 200 persons. And about 130,000, that it's going up every year, maybe 150,000 per year, new patients are added to this population. Globally, it is more than 10 million. Some estimates are as high as 20 million. And the sort of prevalence is about 2 to 3 per 1,000. Depends on which estimate you go by. And the age distribution is really at every decade of life, right from childhood all the way to very senior citizens. And there are really one bulk of patients which are in the younger age group, teenagers and young adults, and this population primarily consists of those patients who've had amputations because of trauma. And it typically consists of upper limb types of amputations, as well as lower limb, but it's the trauma population which is really in this group. And males form a much larger percentage of this population than females. From about from the 30s onwards, every decade of life, the incidence keeps going up. And that is because the incidence of these diseases that I mentioned, diabetes and peripheral vascular disease, goes on increasing, and a larger number end up with amputations. And relatively speaking, you get more females towards the decades of life. Now, amputations can also be categorized based on the level of amputation, and that has really significant implications on the outcome, outcome of quality of life, even after prosthesis. If we look at the upper limb, there are really four or five major sites that are defined. You can have a shoulder disarticulation. You can have what's called a transhumeral fracture through the humerus. You can have an elbow disarticulation. Then you can have a transradial through the forearm. And then you can have a wrist disarticulation. You can also have distal fractures, finger, partial hand fractures, amputations. The commonest one from this group is really the transradial or the below elbow type of amputation. For the lower limb, similarly, we also have multiple levels. You can have a disarticulation through the joint, like the hip, or a transfemoral amputation, a knee disarticulation, or a transtibial, or you can have an ankle disarticulation. You can also have partial foot and even toe amputations. But it's really the transfemoral and the transtibial, which are known as the above knee and below knee, that form the bulk of amputations. Okay? So if you look at that distribution, you really find the lower limbs outnumber the upper limb by far. And within the lower limb, it is really the above knee and the below knee. The below knee is really the most common type of amputation that is seen. And then the above knee, and then in the upper limb is the below elbow. Now, these vary depending on the patient population you're looking at, and also from series to series. But in general terms, this is a typical profile in the U.S. globally, the profile is a little different. As I said, there's a relatively a little bit more of upper limb than lower limb, and some of the levels may differ. But below knee and above knee really is what the bulk of amputations are about. And therefore, if you look at the prosthesis design, guess where the design has really focused? It's focused on the above knee and below knee prosthesis. That is really the largest market. That is really where the largest number of patients need sits. And so that's where the designers have focused their attention. So let's rewind a little bit and look at a brief history of a prosthesis. Now that we know what the profile looks like, let's go back and look at how prostheses have evolved. Okay? And I'm going to try and cover several thousand years in about 2 minutes here. So we'll start way back when, in 3500 BCE. There's a mention actually in the Rig Veda, which is one of the ancient texts from ancient India, of a queen, the queen Vishpala, who actually sustained an amputation of her lower limb and was fitted with a metal prosthesis. And actually went back horseback riding and went into war again and actually won the battle. So that is actually the first written account, at least, that we know. There are no artifacts from there. There's no remnant, obviously, but that's a written account that does exist. And it sort of lends one to sort of believe that perhaps there were prostheses known at that time and designed and used. The first prosthesis that we do have a remnant of is the Egyptian toe. This is from 900 BC, and this was actually found many years ago, and it sits in the museum, I think, in London now. And this is the first prosthesis that we actually know that exists. We found it, and so it again gives us some evidence of the concept of prosthesis design. The famous Italian Roman artifact known as the Capua leg is from about 300 BC. It's actually a wooden stump. It has no moving, bending parts, but it is a prosthesis that was used for above-knee amputations, and it was basically a support system. And the individual could rest their stump on this and use it as a support system. It's not clear how it was fitted onto the individual and how mobility it gave them, but it certainly is a prosthesis from way back when. And then there were actually several hundreds of years of minor modifications, but no real major modifications, till about the 1500s. And the famous surgeon and anatomist, French surgeon anatomist, Paré, actually came up with multiple designs. And his hand is very famous, but he did also come up with a lower limb prosthesis, both for below knee and above knee, which had an articulated knee. And it was remarkable advancement at that time, and it has been sort of described in many different recollections and descriptions, and it really influenced the prosthesis design for a long time following that. The hand that he described and that he actually made and then fitted individuals with, we actually use some of those design features even today, which is remarkable. Even after 500 years, it is still being used. And then there were minor modifications. You know, every decade had some modifications till about the 1800s, when James Pott came up with his prosthesis, which actually was for the lower limb, and then it was brought by Bly into the U.S. in the 1800s and went by the name of the Bly leg, and it had actually moving parts and mechanical gears and cables and so on and so forth. So we were really getting into advanced things by then. But the real big push in the U.S. For prosthesis design first came in the Civil War, and we had prostheses such as this, made of wood and leather, and they were belts and buckles and hooks and so on, for the upper limb and for the lower limb. And it was a big time for big push in advancement in prosthesis design, and a lot of the stuff that came out of that time, again, is still being used today. But if we look at prostheses today, and Gary will go into a lot of detail for this, so I will just take maybe a couple of minutes and talk about it. There are really, you know, three main parts. There's a socket that fits on the stump of the patient. There's a suspension, and there's some device attached to it, whether it's lower limb, upper limb, and it does its function. some form of terminal device. The below knee prosthesis that exists today typically looks something like this, with a socket, and then there's a shin, and there's a foot and ankle. It's made up of metal and different other plastic materials and so on. The aim has been to try and make it as functional and as lightweight as possible. And I'll talk a little bit about the weight issue momentarily. Above knee is the other type of prosthesis, which is very popular. As I said, below and above knee are really the two most common type of amputations. The above knee prosthesis has been much more of a challenge. It's obviously larger, bulkier. It's more complicated. It is more difficult for the patient to use. The energy expended for using an above knee prosthesis is in multiples of what it is for a patient to use a below knee prosthesis. Something to keep in mind from a rehab perspective. And from a clinical perspective, we obviously try to save as much of the limb as possible. And when you do have to convert a below knee amputee to an above knee amputee amputation, that is always a big step. The below elbow prosthesis for the upper limb is the other big one for the upper limb, and this is really the common prosthesis that has a hook as a terminal device and has cables and it has a harness. And this hook actually was first designed in 1912, just exactly 100 years ago. And the hook, in some form or other, slightly modified, is still used today. And it's a robust prosthesis design. It has a lot of advantages. It has some disadvantages as well. And because of that, people have tried to come up with all sorts of alternatives. One that has become very popular in the press more recently is the myoelectric prosthesis, which is basically a computerized robotic arm, if you will, which has got all sorts of gadgets and computers and everything else inside. It's got a lot of pluses and minuses, and maybe after we finish we can discuss and debate relative advantages and disadvantages of these prostheses. So I'll just end very quickly with two things. One point about challenges that individuals who have prostheses face, and then I'll end with a little case story about one of the projects that I was involved with. So if you look at this has come from a recent large survey that was done by Johns Hopkins, and they looked at a patient profile that had more of lower limb users, but a fair amount of upper limb prosthetic users as well. And by and large, you find that the great majority of patients are fairly satisfied or very satisfied with their prosthesis. And this is a larger chunk of the population surveyed here was lower limb amputees, as I mentioned. But it's interesting, if you dive in a little deeply in here, you'll find that the one thing that they are least satisfied with is the comfort. So we're not talking about functionality. We're not talking about how much robot this has, how many moving parts it has. The part that the patients are usually concerned about is the comfort. And if you look at that, a very close second is the weight. And one of the problems with these very complex prostheses is comfort and weight. So it's interesting to balance, the various things that individuals need and want. I want to end with one other point about a case history, it's obvious that this is a team approach. That's why we've got two people doing this talk, and you've got a number of folks around the patient. The patient is always the center, and we mustn't lose sight of that. Everything is designed for the patient, and the patient really needs to lead the way, and we need to work around the patient as a team. And in addition to the professional team, there's also the family and the social team that the patient has, and all these people around the patient can either make or break the experience for the patient. So I'm going to quickly go through a case study. I've been involved with a lot of prosthesis design in resource-limited settings, and this is a case study of a prosthesis design that we did in India. This is a 18-year-old young man called Kamal. We met him about 5 years ago, and he lives in a city called Jaipur in India, which is in the northern part of India. And in childhood, he sustained an injury which resulted in an amputation, above-knee amputation, on his left side. And this is the prosthesis that he had. It was an above-knee prosthesis that was supplied to him. It wasn't very stable. He had difficulty in walking. He would tend to fall. And so the challenge was to design something for him that would improve his gait. And the other challenge, which was actually a bigger challenge, was the cost. The prosthesis that he had was a plastic single-axis prosthesis, which cost about $20. And there are all these prostheses that are available on the market, including the $10,000 one at the other end, $20,000, thank you, Gary, which obviously was no use for him. So we have to be at this end of the spectrum, and we have to try and improve the prostheses. So long story short, we obviously made a trip to India. This is the group that greeted us. This is Joel. He's my PhD student who sort of led the effort. And we did some needs finding. And after needs finding, we characterized what we needed to come up with. We went back to the drawing board, started off with simple foam cardboard prototypes, something that allowed us to bend. And from then on, it was a long journey, went on through several months of prototyping. We were in the machine shop. We did all sorts of load testing. And ultimately, we came up with a prosthesis. This is us doing a load testing for the trial prosthesis not too far away from this building. And I'm glad to say that it didn't break. But that's the type of testing we had to do. And we ultimately ended up getting a prosthesis that was fitted on Kamal. And his walking improved, but not only could he walk, but he also could ride a bicycle. And so this is a little video when we went back a second time, and that's him on the bike riding a bicycle and carrying his friend with him as well on the back. And there you can see he's fitted with the knee, and he's riding a bicycle. So this was a huge improvement in the quality of life that he could lead, and it cost us $20. That was the cost of this knee, and because of that, we were quite proud of the attention it got, and it was voted as the 50 best inventions of the year in 2009 by Time magazine, and so we got energized by that, and we're now actually working on an upper limb prosthesis to do the exact same thing. DARPA, as you know, is making an upper limb prosthesis that, you know, has 56 degrees of freedom or something like that. It's a very large number, and so is the price. It's a $100,000 prosthesis, I believe, or more. And so our idea is from 20,000 we canceled three zeros and brought down 20. So we're trying to do the same thing with the $100,000 prosthesis and make it for less than $100. It may not do everything that the other prosthesis does, but if it does 95%, 90%, that's good enough at 0.1% of the cost. So what does the future hold? That's something that we can discuss and debate. The future is bright, in my opinion, but it's an unknown. What I do know is that the future right now in the next 20 minutes is that you'll listen to Gary. So I'll leave you with Gary, and then we'll come back and take any questions or comments. So let me get your slide up. There you go. If you want that, or you should certainly have that. Yeah. Okay, thank you. That's a great segue into all of this. It was really fun to work on that Jiper Knee project. I was in on that very early and continue to work with the team up at DREV in San Francisco on new iterations of that. So that's been a really fun project. I'm a prosthetist. I design artificial limbs and braces. And so I brought a prosthesis today. We're going to talk a little bit about that. I tend to talk a little bit more esoteric about the things that are important and why prostheses are important. One of the things that the history brings up is that while the device and the material changes, the physics of using these devices is exactly the same as it was back in ancient times. We haven't gotten good enough yet. We still have that human interface that's really important. And that's what differentiates a prosthesis from a robot. A robot's got some interface, some tactile things going on, you know, however you interface with that. But the prosthesis really has to be a device that's worn.
And that's a big differentiation. And for those of you that went to the robotics course the other day, heard that from some of the international standards folks as well, that they want to separate that robotic prosthetic thing out just a little bit. So this guy's pretty interesting. He brought a little more publicity to the prosthetic world, and that was really fun for us. That was unbelievable, actually, that we could get this sort of notoriety for someone who has both legs amputated. He's also a really nice guy. But that's not necessarily what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about why can't we just put a foot on someone, anyone, and let them run or let it be better than a human foot. What's the limiting factors and what goes into this whole thing? Well, part of it is the fact that not every patient looks like that. Some of them look like this. As we talked about, this is the majority of our patients, our elderly peripheral vascular disease US-based patient. But there's also the congenital patients who look like this. And if you have one foot, it's not going to fit on this guy the same way or work on the old guy, or it's going to work on the sprinter, or this level of amputation being a hip disarticulation versus above the knee versus below the knee. So that human interface part, if you don't get that right, you can put whatever foot and knee and ankle or you want on there, it's not going to work. So today we're going to talk about some of these moments of truth in prosthetic design, that human interface design. And I heard this comment about the moments of truth at a talk I was at a couple weeks ago. And moments of truth are really interesting. And I like to think about a moment of truth as like when you go into a restaurant. There's a whole bunch of moments of truth when you walk in. You know, is the host or hostess friendly and well-dressed? Is it clean? Is the ambiance nice? If it's not, that's a moment of truth that you kind of go, well, okay, maybe this isn't the place for me. But if that goes well and you get to your table and the service is great, and then the food comes and the food is great and it's this wonderful experience, and then you get to the end and there's a rat, are you going to go back to that restaurant? Probably not. If everything else was perfect, that last moment of truth led to failure. We got five moments of truth in prosthetics, which I like to refer to as the five C's. And some of you have heard this before a few times. So the five C's, the five moments of truth for prosthetics, really are comfort, like we talked about, and we're going to get into these a little bit more. Cosmesis. How does it look? How does it function? Right? But thank God there's a C. Cost. And the cool factor. Because cool is really in right now. So we got to talk about the cool factor as well. So what makes something comfortable? What makes especially a prosthesis comfortable? Well, first of all, is transference of pressure. So I'm going to pull this guy out for a second here. This is your standard sort of below-the-knee type prosthesis. And this socket, like Sakti talked about, is that transference of pressure. Now, we could make this out of a nice, cushy, soft, wonderful material, and it might be comfortable. Silicones and some of the other materials that absorb pressure are all really nice, but we also have to transfer pressure. We have to allow the movement of the limb to move the prosthesis appropriately, too. So if it's too soft and you go to kick your foot out, all of a sudden the prosthesis is 3 feet back there and you're hoping it's in front of you. So it's not just transference of vertical pressure, it's transference of horizontal pressure so that when you move your leg, the prosthesis moves with you. So at this stage, we have to take care of that in a custom way because every limb is different. Everybody's got a different sensation, a different pain threshold, different bony prominences that all tie into this comfort aspect of the socket. You can't make too much noise. There's some great feet that are coming out, and we'll talk about the future, that are these really cool microprocessor, hydraulic-based steam engine, that can push you up a hill, but they are so loud that you can't even imagine walking in a library or a quiet office with this thing. Heat is a big problem. We have to disperse pressure over the greatest possible area without restricting motion, but it gets kind of warm in there. And people are sort of heat intolerant. So heat, especially for some of our guys in India, is a huge issue. it can't be a nuisance. And what I mean by that is that it can't take 4 hours to put on to do one thing. Right? If it takes a minute to put on, great. If you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night and it takes you 3 minutes to put your prosthesis on, it ain't going to happen. So there's a nuisance factor that has to be integrated into this comfort concept. And then we talked about weight as well. If it weighs 40 pounds, you're probably not going to wear it. And that's going to come up in the future, especially when we start talking about some of this fancy DARPA project. Weight is a big issue. Weight was a huge issue for this young lady. Everything else was perfect. The fit was good. She was comfortable. She was able to work the prosthesis. She was able to work the terminal device. She was able to pick things up. But I got a note that said, it's too heavy. I just can't wear it all day. So that's that moment of truth that caused that failure in this case, in my mind. How does it look? Well, we all have our own idea of what is cosmetic. This is not really what I had in mind. A friend of mine. It really has to do with how you perceive yourself. What happens after you've gone through a devastating injury or you've lost your leg to vascular disease? Does that change how you perceive yourself and how you want to perceive others to perceive you as well? And that's the basis of cosmesis in my mind. So this guy lost his outside two fingers, last two fingers, and we made him a cosmetic prosthesis. And he actually liked this device. It looks pretty good. Hand-painted, hand-toned, $10,000, and it does that. This is moving. But it looks nice, and cosmesis in his case was the critical factor. He could do everything he needed to do. He didn't need the function. He just wanted it to look like his other hand so that people wouldn't comment or look at him in the grocery store or whatever it was. And so he was very satisfied with this device. This is also a cosmetic device. So cosmesis is really in the eyes of the beholder in these cases. And we have to keep that in mind of what cosmetic means to those individuals in this process. How does it function? Does it do what it's supposed to do? In this guy who was working on the San Mateo Bridge, a beam fell on both arms and he traumatically lost both hands. This is a devastating injury. This is a 95% disability. He can't eat. He can't go to the bathroom. Right? He can't do a lot of things when you lose both hands. So the prosthesis better be reliable. It better be able to do the things that we expect it to do. How does it function? Can he pick up his phone? Can he dial his phone? Right? How's he going to do that? And can the prosthesis do that, or is there another mechanism that we can use to get to that point? How do we adapt? And can we allow him to adapt with a prosthesis as well? These are important considerations. Sometimes function is just a single task, and I'm a huge fan of this concept, this idea that we have task-specific tools. This guy had a shoulder disarticulation. Or actually, he was higher. He had what we call a four-quarter or a scapulothoracic. So basically, they took off from basically his right arm from here. You don't see many on the left because your heart's in the way. When you get a tumor up in here, they take off that whole segment. And all he ever wanted to do was go scuba diving. Right? So we made him a device that had a hook on the outside that held his tanks in place. That was it. He was fine. He could do anything else he wanted, but he couldn't scuba dive. So sometimes that approach to things, very simple approaches to complex problems, is really where we need to approach these cases. Cool. I got a lot of thoughts about cool, but I'll keep most of those to myself. You know, this idea in the media is kind of killing us at times. Right, this cool factor. And every day I turn on and I see another cool device, another revolutionary device that's going to save the world. And we don't always narrow down on the other C's. And it's becoming more of a problem. So the cool factor can be the Vanderbilt knee, which is a new device that's come out. And there was a big thing in the media about this guy going up Sears Tower with this knee, and it's able to propel him in 101 stories. That's fabulous. And I sat down with the designer and I said, well, so who's going to pay for this thing? He goes, that's not our problem. You know, this is cool. It's really cool. It's a great thing. But the cost is so prohibitive at this point that I'm not sure it's going to get to anybody who can really use it. We'll see. And then it becomes a cost issue. I love this car. I want this car. Oh, well. So let's see if I can get Jesse to work here. So this kind of... Are you going to go? Ah. So some of you have already seen this. This is the DARPA arm. Let's see if I can... An early version of the DARPA arm. Yeah. I believe it's 27 degrees of freedom. But trying to control that is really interesting. So you can see on his right side he has his usual prosthesis, and on his left side he has targeted muscle reintervention. They move the nerves to his chest wall, and he is able to single out particular activities through those nerves. He's actually getting some sensory feedback too. But to control the hand, fingers, elbow, shoulder. Well, these are absolutely unheard of activities for someone with this level of amputation in the past. And so it's really kind of amazing. Now, I went to a targeted muscle reinnervation course last year, and Jesse was there and another woman that had had it, and I sat down with a woman for a second just talking about how this was all going for her. And she said, you know, it's really amazing. I can pick things up. I can move my hand over here. I can change, you know, my clothes easier. I can do all of these things. But I can only wear it for about 15 minutes at a time because it's just so damn heavy. So we lose function because of our other moments of truth, I think. I don't even know what it's going to cost in the end. And with declining reimbursement and declining activity from all of the insurers and changes in healthcare, we're in this sort of paradox in terms of what we can do for folks. We've got all of these great tools and high-tech things going on, but the cost is so prohibitive that they may never see the light of day on someone who really could use these. So we have to try to balance that in our lives here. So keep that in mind in your design world. Let's see if I can find your... Right, there it is. So really the perfect device, like the hook. The hook's a perfect device, except it's not very cosmetic. But it covers everything. It's durable, it's cheap, it's lightweight, it's functional. We're just a little shy on the cosmesis, which I think is why it failed. But the perfect device is one that balances all of those for the individual, not just for the engineer. So with that, I think we'll start to look at some of the, just talk about the future, answer some questions, talk about prostheses, and have our little panel discussion.
We have, I think, about 15 minutes or so, less than that. What I thought is that Gary has a lot of pockets, so we would love for you to talk to him. Give us any reactions, thoughts, comments, questions,
and sort of just engage in the back. I'm curious about the leg that you built here. What materials were used to
attach to this? It is actually made of oil-filled nylon. That's what it is at the moment. And we're looking at another material. And the weight of that is less than a kilo, about a pound. Less than a pound, yeah. Very light. And it's all made at one heat.
It's in a couple of ways. It's a nice level, actually, because you get the advantage of maintaining all of the muscle groups that are above the knee. Anytime you go above the knee, you start to lose muscle. And so by maintaining that balance, you get a much more stable limb. You also have the ability, through the knee joint, to put weight on the end. So much like Oscar Pistorius, he can put weight on the end of his limb. If he has an advantage, that's really it. And so the knee disarticulation, you can put weight through the end of the prosthesis. You can actually stand on the end without having really any pain. So that brings forth some advantages. The disadvantage of that is that now you have to find a knee that sits really close Otherwise, when you sit, the knee sticks out funny and impairs your pants and does all kinds of interesting things. So there's advantages and disadvantages to it. I'm a big fan of disarticulation versus through bone, typically, if there's an option.
Historically, though, the classic TT used to be to avoid disarticulation. And if you have a very, very short stump, a very, very short meloneal stump, it would not be enough to fit a prosthesis, then you would have to make it a bust knee. And avoid needless disarticulation because the end of the stump becomes very large and bulbous and bulky. But that was used to be the case. And now prosthesis design has evolved and knee disarticulation is fairly standard for fitting prosthesis now. But if you look at classical teaching, you might get an idea of what they think.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It depends on what's there. So in Jesse's case, what they actually did was they took out part of the brachial plexus and moved it into the chest wall, which is kind of a major surgical thing regardless. And so with our congenital groups, as long as the anatomy is normal from that point forward, then in theory it would work. It really depends on the anatomy, like the cause of the congenital things. You know, you can be born with for no reason at all, or it couldn't be syndromic. It could have to do with some other syndrome or problem that, you know, whatever it may be. So it really depends on what's left and what you can tie into. And so in theory, yes, it could work.
Interesting point to keep in mind. Absolutely, I agree with everything Gary says. One other point to add to that, and Gary sort of alluded to this right at the beginning, there's a big difference in robots. One of the things between the differences is that humans adapt. There is plasticity within our biological system, including neuroplasticity. So those individuals who are amputations from birth, congenitally, they develop in a very different way. And they can do so many things that you wouldn't imagine it's possible to do with a missing limb or even with two missing upper limbs. I've seen patients who can feed themselves using their legs, and they can write using their toes. They can do remarkable things. So whenever you design a prosthesis for somebody who is congenitally has an amputation, that is a huge bar to sort of cross. Because they will do the things that are easiest for them.
I have a slide for a talk that shows this guy who's about so tall, and he's got this huge prosthesis on, and it's just overkill. It's too much. We all have a gadget tolerance, and some of our congenital folks are particularly sensitive to that. It's very easy to throw a bunch of stuff at them that they typically will reject for a variety of reasons. That's correct. Because it's very interesting what's happening in Washington. You know, kids that are coming out of Afghanistan and Iraq and going through Department of Defense are getting whatever they want prosthetically. Typically 4, 5, 6 prostheses, you know, all doing different things, different knees, different feet. All of this is whatever they want all the time. It's not a sustainable method of provision of care. And so dropping when the budget for the VA comes through again, and that's starting to dwindle a little bit, we're going to run into some barriers to these, to access to some of these things, even through the VA. And we'll have to see where that all goes.
I should mention the guy that's responsible, or was responsible for providing all the prosthetics of the VA, is himself an amputee, and he uses a hook.
Yeah.
And he has access to, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
He uses the hook. But for him, it was the most functional thing, and now the most important thing.
Yeah, and Fred, you're talking about Fred Danz. Yeah, Fred's... Yeah, always use the hook, 50 years, it's great, it's the best thing. He was featured on something where he was doing one of these cool multi-finger hands, and he said, oh, that's the greatest thing in the world, and he went and put his hook back on and went home, so.
Yeah, sensory
feedback's a huge problem with myoelectric. It's better with the hooks, which is part of the reason that they're somewhat successful, is that you can get a sense of how much you're grasping and how, you know, whether it's opening or closing and how much pressure. None of the myoelectric systems have any sensory feedback to date. It works in some of the targeted muscle reinnervation, and we're not sure why, but when you move the brachial plexus into the chest wall and you push in certain areas, he'll tell you, oh, I can feel my thumb, oh, I can feel that finger, oh, and so we're just now trying to figure out how to manipulate that so that it makes sense of what's going on down at the hand. So it really has more to do with the targeted muscle reinnervation than the actual prosthesis. Okay. Go ahead.
Can you talk a little bit about what factors affect fit in your targeted prosthesis? I read specifically that hopefully patients might have issues with skin being thinner or less circulation.
Yes. Yes. All of those things. Yeah, the bone spurs are less of an issue, but bony prominences are an issue. I think the biggest challenge for me personally in fitting pretty much anybody, but the elderly or the dysvascular even more so than some, has to do with constant change of volume. Because these are so intimately fit, we are supporting those tissues sort of throughout, right? We want to cover, put pressure as much area over as much area as possible to decrease those point pressures. When the volume of the limb changes, the limb sinks further down into the prosthesis, and then they start to get pressures in various areas. And some of our vascular patients can't feel, so it's an interesting problem. But all patients, and all of us, if you'll notice, some days your rings are loose and some days they're tight, watches. And this just is a huge problem for someone wearing a prosthesis. They may sometimes have to add socks during the day to compensate for change. If they go have a margarita at night, this volume change, with lots of salt, not just the margarita, that volume change affects how the prosthesis fits and feels and how it works. So I think that's my biggest issue, regardless of cause.
For that example, are there some simple things that you can take from checking systems of machine shops where they have to plant a regular object and they have a whole radial set of separate little jaws that squeeze in. If those squoze against the silicone thing, that could easily be tweakable during the day.
Yeah, and yes, we would love to see that. We've tried air, and we've tried oil, and we've tried a variety of media to try to change the socket volume, if you will, as the patient changes throughout the day. What we found with some of them is that if the patient has control of that, they tend to really crank it up, and they really want it tight, and so then all of a sudden they have no circulation, and we got a much bigger problem. Yeah, so there's a balance to be had. Automating a system like that would be a spectacular thing to do.
Has there been any progress in connecting the prosthetic right to the bone? I know they were looking at that many years ago, and I just wondered if there was any advances.
I don't know if there's been any advances.
There's some work done in small prostheses for, you know, smaller applications, distant to the wrist. So individual fingers, thumb, and those are prostheses that have been implanted, much like dental implants, directly to the bone.
Yeah. So above the knee, they won't work for below the knee?
Yeah,
above the knee, the people that get them, and mostly it's Sweden, Spain, some of the Australia, there's a few. The people that get them, their x-rays look horrible. I mean, they're just open spaces, and they drain. They have to wear a towel around their leg because they're constantly draining. We haven't found a way to let the bone-skin-titanium interface work well together yet. So, it's an issue.
I really enjoyed this presentation because I have three artificial jaws. But I'm really curious how you decided to go into this field versus other choices that you probably have.
Do you want to do this?
Yeah,
okay. Wow, you know, that's an interesting question. I suppose it's one of those things where if you keep your eyes open long enough, you sort of find where you belong, and that's sort of what happened with me. I was a kinesiology major as an undergraduate, and so I loved human mechanics, motion, all of the motion analysis, all the anatomy, all the physiology. But, you know, medical school sounded a little daunting. Engineering was a little too specific. Physical therapy was boring. So this sort of happened along the way, and I don't think I could have picked a better path.
For me, I went into orthopedics after medical school with the idea because I had love for physics and engineering and biomechanics, overlaying that on clinical stuff or anatomy and physiology and things of that nature. Early on in my medical training, I had the opportunity to work with amputees as well as patients with spinal cord injury. And so those two became major focuses for my work after my training. And I felt that this was an area which was somewhat neglected, and it had some challenge in it because of being interdisciplinary in its nature. And both those things are perfect places where I get attracted to.
Like we practice.